This is Morning Edition. I'm Bob Edwards. Software has become one of the most important technologies of the modern world, yet it's one of the least understood. It's not made of metal or silicone. It's created out of logic, instructions that give order and meaning to a computer's electrical circuitry. The word software usually calls to mind colorful boxes on the shelves at your local computer store. Most software, though, is hidden from view. It connects your telephone calls, starts your car, and keeps airplanes on course. NPR's Dan Charles has the first of three reports.
There was a time when the workings of a clock represented physically our system of time. The swing of a pendulum ticked off the seconds, and a set of wheels and gears of different sizes translated that steady, predictable movement into the motion of hands that measured minutes and hours. In a digital watch today, that relationship, that logic in our system of time, is reduced to computer instructions, software. That's the simplest use of software. It's replaced complex and expensive machinery and makes watches cheaper. But software has its greatest impact in giving machines intelligence. They can react to changing conditions like the wishes of their owner. Take this example. Let's say it's 40 years ago. You're an enterprising inventor, and you're trying to rig up equipment to accomplish the following sequence of events. You're not home. Your clock, when it strikes 9 o'clock, turns on a radio sitting on the kitchen table.
When a girl marries, Maxwell House, that right, mellow, satisfying coffee that's good to the last drop, presents When a Girl Marries.
Simultaneously, a tape recorder starts up, recording this broadcast. An hour later, the radio dial spins a quarter turn to the right to another station.
The Lone Ranger!
The tape records this broadcast, too. Then both machines turn themselves off. 2 hours of recorded radio awaits your return home. Now, 40 years ago, you may have been able to pull this off if you were a mechanical genius. Today, thanks to software, it happens routinely every time you program your VCR. Programming is exactly the right word. You are activating the machine's internal controls. It's software. Take another example, a far more complicated machine that constantly has to react to changing conditions, the modern automobile.
It's a little bit rough here, actually, for the test I wanted to do.
Joe Adams, an engineer with Chrysler, is driving down a road just outside Chelsea, Michigan. It's a private road owned by Chrysler, where the company's employees drive new cars around a racetrack over murderous bumps and down steep hills just to see how they work.
What I'm doing here is I'm on the gas here, and I'm letting off the gas here all the way from about 50 miles an hour here.
Adams wants to see what happens when his foot comes off the accelerator. Does the car just coast along smoothly, or does the motor act like a brake and slow the car down?
What I'm going to do now is I'll take a piece of data on that, and then I'll change the engine control program to make that feel different.
The engine control program is a computer program, and the computer that's running this software, the engine control unit, is mounted in a rugged steel box down beside the engine. There's one of these computers on any car you buy these days, but the one on this car is hooked up to a screen and a keyboard riding along on top of the dashboard. So while he's still driving along, Joe Adams can reach up, tap a few keys, and change one small piece of that engine control program. What he's changing is one number, a variable, he calls it, that helps determine how much fuel the motor gets.
Now what I can do is I can go into that variable there and I'm going to change that and I'm going to take another bit of data here.
Adams takes the car back up to 50 miles an hour and takes his foot off the throttle again. This time, inside the engine controller, a slightly different calculation takes place. This calculation involves thousands of variables, the speed of the engine, the temperature of the motor, but this time, one variable is different.
So, I can feel that change that just took place there.
The car slowed down more abruptly. It jerked us forward in our seats ever so slightly. That's not a good thing, Adam says. The first setting was better. Now, old-style mechanics had ways to do this as well. Their tools were the physical properties of metal and air. They hook together gears, springs, and vacuum chambers to make sure when you gave the engine gas, it surged forward, and when you took your foot off the accelerator, it slowed down, but not too quickly. But that mechanical system basically just connected the gas pedal to a valve that let air into the motor. Joe Adams's software is like a contraption that connects everything in the motor to everything else. It connects them through logic. Thousands and thousands of if-then statements. If we're straining to get up a hill, then adjust the moment the spark plug fires. If the engine is hot, then change the mixture of fuel and air. If the weather is 90 degrees or 10 below zero, then make other changes. This all happens simultaneously, thousands of times each second.
And you just never had that fine control with mechanical systems where you'd kind of have to say, okay, let's make it start and run at 20 and make it start and run at 70 and make sure that it at least starts at 100 degrees. And kind of in between, you can't check those points.
Change that software and you change the car. Joe Adams says starting with cars made this year, you'll be able to get what amounts to a software upgrade for your car. Just go to a Chrysler dealer.
He will dial up on his computer link. He'll get the software over the computer link, and then he will then flash that into your car without even taking the module out of the car. And you'll be on your way in 15 minutes with better fuel economy and cleaner emissions if the change affected that, or if it was just a drivability glitch that was fixed. And you're on your way without the hassle and the stocking charges. It's just a lot of money that's been saved by having the computer smart enough to accept new input over their life.
This is the apparent magic of software. It's like a set of cables and springs and valves of unimaginable complexity. Yet they never rust or leak or break. They operate at lightning speed, and when you want to change them a bit, you don't need to manufacture new parts. You just rewrite a little bit of the program. David Fisher funds research on software at the government's National Institute of Standards and Technology.
It's hard to find any product in the world today that has any degree of complexity that isn't mostly software.
Look closely at the largest and most complex machine you can find, the telephone system, for instance, or a radar system built for the military, or an assembly line. At its heart, like a hidden choreographer, chances are you'll find software. The people who own these machines and factories turn to software to replace mechanical controls, as Chrysler's engineers did, but also to replace people. The first jobs it takes over are those where there's a predictable response to a predictable situation, an if-then statement. If a caller wants John Smith, then dial extension 247. At a checkout counter, if the can carries such and such a barcode pattern, then charge the customer $2.99. Corporate managers and government officials alike have come to depend on software. Increasingly, financial success and public safety depend on it. And that has raised worries among some people who are most intimately familiar with how software works. They say the larger and more complex the computer program, the more likely it is to contain hidden flaws, and the harder it is to find them. This is Dan Charles reporting.
This is Morning Edition. I'm Bob Edwards. Every year, computers leap forward in speed and power. A computer that once filled a room now fits neatly inside a briefcase. What often doesn't keep pace is software, the programs that are the brains of a computer. It's the software that turns a computer's electrical circuitry into a tool for solving problems. Many computer specialists think software is in a long-standing state of crisis. NPR's Dan Charles has the second of three reports.
Edsger Dijkstra is one of the pioneers of computer software. He was born in Holland, studied theoretical physics there, and after World War II, he started playing around with some of the very first computers. He had a choice, devote his life to theoretical physics or to programming computers. He chose programming.
I had the feeling that programming was a greater intellectual challenge.
How many physicists agreed with you?
None of them, I think.
In physics, Dijkstra says, you always have an excuse for answers that turn out to be wrong. The natural universe is just too complex.
In the case of programming, if it doesn't work, there is no excuse. You have made the mess yourself.
And often, as Dijkstra and others began creating the first software, it was a mess. Computers were always crashing. By 1968, some of the leading computer scientists in the world met in Germany and coined the term the software crisis. Software, they announced, was rapidly becoming the weakest, most fragile part of the whole computing industry. Dijkstra was at that meeting.
I remember that I was very excited, wrote a very excited letter to my parents that at last it was admitted that it was difficult, so now something could be done about it.
The computer industry has tried to do something about it ever since, but the software crisis just won't go away.
It's All Things Considered. I'm Noah Adams. AT&T engineers have found the problem that triggered the phone company's worst breakdown yesterday.
Yesterday, in this case, was January 15, 1990.
It's a bug in the computer software that controls the company's long-distance service. An estimated 50 million calls went nowhere, causing major disruptions for airlines, hotels, stock traders, and anybody else who depends on the phone.
This sort of failure, software that collapses for mysterious reasons, is Edsger Dijkstra's nightmare. Not only does it still happen, software has become so important, the consequences of this sort of failure keep growing. Also, as software takes on new jobs, it's become more complicated. That increases the chances something can go wrong. Take the story of the nation's air traffic control software. In a federal aviation center near Leesburg, Virginia, air traffic controllers sit in front of glowing green screens, tracking jetliners through the sky. It's software that turns the radar echoes from the sky into a picture on the screen. And this particular software was created to run this particular computer system. In fact, it will only run on these 20-year-old computers. And although the computer program itself doesn't wear out, James Kidd, who works here, says the computers do.
These frequently don't work anymore. This, because it's 1960s technology, doesn't have any replacement parts for it. The only way we can actually fix these things is to cannibalize other ones. So when this breaks, we have to cannibalize something else someplace else to put it inside of this. And when you eventually run out of cannibalization, you're dead in the water.
The Federal Aviation Administration started trying a decade ago to replace this archaic computer system. The key was software. The FAA wanted a new system to do basically what the old software already did, but the new software was supposed to run on standard, widely used computers. That's so the FAA can buy new, faster computers in the future and still run the same software, just like you still use the same word processing software when you switch to a more powerful PC. But neither the FAA nor the company that won the contract, IBM, could resist the temptation to keep asking their software developers to add new features, like having the screens display more and more information. Except that each reworking of the system created new problems, new bugs that caused the whole system to crash. Fixing one set of bugs introduced different ones. The software was supposed to cost $4.5 billion. Last year, cost estimates rose to $7 billion, and the FAA decided to cancel large parts of it. A congressional committee hauled everybody involved in the debacle up to Capitol Hill for a public tongue-lashing. Congressman Greg Laughlin of Texas focused his anger on IBM, which had just sold the division working on this project for $1.5 billion.
We're sitting here talking about dollars, and I don't understand any of the computers, I don't understand any of the engineering, but I understand that we got a system that's out of whack, and one company is able to drive $1.5 billion for doing a poor job.
When people in the software business tell this story, they act like they've seen it all before, and they have. David Fisher of the Department of Commerce's National Institute of Standards and Technology says, according to one study, of all the major software projects that private companies and the government start, between 70% and 90% of them fail. The reason, he says, is they'd write their software and find out it was full of flaws, bugs. Now, when you're just doing a spreadsheet on your PC, you may not care too much if the computer freezes a couple of times each year. But when it comes to other computer programs, you do care.
If your software is to control an airplane, if your software is to run a factory, if your software is to help a bank manage its investments, you can't afford those sorts of errors. And yet they're just as unavoidable. And so what happens is that something is produced that cannot be put into operational use.
All of which raises the question, why is it so hard to create a perfect product? Software developers give a lot of reasons. For one thing, a computer program is not a physical thing you can inspect. It's made up of directions, instructions, like a fat book of recipes for different dishes. Except all the recipes in this case are interrelated. The amount of time you're supposed to cook the omelet, let's say, may change depending on how much pepper you put on the fried potatoes. a software bug would be, it turns out when you're making a particular combination of these dishes at once, you run out of skillets, or there's no way the dishes can all be done on time. But the bug only appears in rare circumstances. It's not easy to find it unless you try every possible combination of dishes. Also, not a single comma in any recipe can be misplaced. There's one other difficulty. Suppose the people writing this cookbook had never cooked an omelet before. They didn't even have a clear idea what the steps are to making one. Janice Sharpless, who developed software for one of AT&T's telephone switches, says increasingly that's the problem software developers face.
In order to realize it, you have to be able to visualize it. And I think that in many places we are pushing the frontier of what we know how to do with software. We don't. When you sit down and you try to string those instructions together, you just can't quite get it to work out right. It's kind of like when you write a paragraph in the book and you sit back and you read it and you go, you know, this just doesn't capture the idea that I wanted.
Edsger Dijkstra, who now teaches at the University of Texas, has become something of a doomsday prophet about software. He says people who should know better still underestimate the difficulty and the dangers of software. They rush ahead with new programs to fix new problems, and they end up with software that's too complicated to understand. They've forgotten the most basic rule of software, he says. You have to keep it simple. If you don't, sooner or later, you will pay the price.
And for a long time, the price will be in clumsiness, and sooner or later, the price is in terms of a collapse.
When it comes to many computer programs, like the air traffic control system, collapse is not acceptable. And that fact has inspired people to renew their search for tools that may finally, after 30 years of failure, make software as reliable and predictable as hardware. This is Dan Charles reporting.
Tomorrow, the quest for flawless software. This is Morning Edition. I'm Bob Edwards. Most people have heard of bugs in computer software. They're usually the problem when your personal computer freezes. But software bugs can be far more disastrous than that. They have shut down telephone service in cities. And 9 years ago in Texas, defective software in a hospital X-ray machine caused the machine to hit two patients with a lethal dose of radiation. The patients died. NPR's Dan Charles concludes a series on software with a report on bugs in software and possible solutions to a very dangerous problem.
No engineer, no research scientist has as much freedom to create something from scratch as the developer of software. Even an architect designing a house has physical constraints. Wooden beams and concrete blocks, pipes and doors and windows all come in standard sizes. That's what the architect has to work with. David Fisher, a software specialist with the National Institute of Standards and Technology, says when he's writing software, he's only limited by his own imagination and by his ability to transform a particular task into instructions for a computer.
You don't have these constraints. The physical limitations are a non-issue. They just don't impact. The trouble is that freedom, that flexibility, that softness also probably undermines success.
That freedom allows programmers to produce towering skyscrapers of logic capable of doing amazing things, but the more complicated the programs, the more likely they are to contain hidden flaws. One of the biggest programs of all, the Empire State Building of software, is the telephone system.
When a person goes off hook, there's a signal that goes back to the office, and the hardware picks up that change of state.
Janice Sharpless of AT&T has written some of this software herself.
Then it alerts, like, the central processor with an interrupt, basically, that somebody went off hook. And the basic operating system then starts up a program that is yours and yours alone for that call. That's your property, so to speak.
Just putting a simple call through may involve 500,000 individual computer instructions. There are other programs that handle special features like call waiting or call return. even more software's there to figure out what's happening when something goes wrong in the network. And then there's the software that allows a phone switch to work in foreign countries. It all adds up to 15 million lines of programming instructions, lines of code to run a single telephone switch. That's more lines than you'll find in a complete set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Then, says Lee Stetcher, also of AT&T, consider that every telephone switch is constantly sending and receiving signals from other switches all around the world.
So you're talking tens of thousands of machines all communicating together, all themselves with stored program in them. And within a given machine, you're talking literally hundreds of microprocessors.
All of which means this system is too large and complicated for anyone to understand completely. Edsger Dijkstra, a pioneer in software development who teaches at the University of Texas, says at one telephone company, he won't say which one, programmers revised some of the software in their phone switch one day. The new software, they thought, meant another part of the program wasn't needed at all, so they took it out. But then, for reasons no one could explain, the switch stopped working.
The only thing they could do was immediately replace that piece of superfluous software and make it a company rule that one was allowed to add software, but you were never allowed to take something away.
For Dijkstra, that's a frightening situation. It means something is happening that you don't understand, which means, for all you know, a change you made in the software last week may cause the system to collapse 2 months from now. Dijkstra is a mathematician, and he believes in the tools of mathematics. Every important computer program, he says, is really like a long scientific formula, and you can use mathematics to prove that it is correct, that it gives you the correct answer under all circumstances. This is the formal methods approach to software. It's rigorous, takes a lot of time, and requires highly trained people. Some people say the idea of using it on something as huge as the telephone system is ludicrous. Dijkstra says the people who make that argument are fools. People have used formal methods to create highly reliable software, but mainly in Europe. They've never really caught on in the U.S. Dijkstra, who's Dutch, blames that on American culture. Americans don't appreciate mathematics, he says. They're sloppy in details, and they're always in a hurry. They'd rather just try something out first and try to fix whatever problems come up later. David Fisher of the National Institute of Standards and Technology says it is a cultural difference.
But the point is, we succeed in areas where, by any reasonable logic, says it's not possible to succeed.
Again, take the phone system, Fisher says.
There are known to be bugs in the telephone system. And furthermore, bugs that are potentially disastrous.
A phone conversation takes up space in a phone switch's memory. Sometimes when people hang up, the switch fails to reclaim that memory, so it just sits there unused. That means phone lines do too, and before long, all the phone lines could be sitting there idle while customers get busy signals.
Where these bugs are arising from is not known.
This happens?
Yes, this happens all the time. However, clever solution. You have something that's called a daemon, which is just a kind of a autonomous software process going on in the background that runs through the system and looks for memory that is in this state and gives it back. And so even though we haven't found the source of the problem, and although the bug is still there, we end up with a very reliable system.
It's a typically American solution, Fisher says.
It's the sort of thing that a mathematician, a Dijkstra, would find absolutely appalling. But we're successful at it.
Does that mean we run the risk of the catastrophic bug out there somewhere that we never quite caught?
Sure. It's certainly the way we build software in America today.
But the way we build software in America today is changing. Discipline and order is replacing trial and error. Structure is placing boundaries on individual creativity. AT&T's Lee Stetcher.
We're beyond the stage right now where one person can go out there and hack a little piece of software together and provide any of these capabilities. We're way beyond that, by the way.
Frank Lanza, who's president of the Loral Corporation, has been in charge of complicated software projects for the Pentagon. Last year, he took on the job of building new software for the nation's air traffic control system.
Management is the first important ingredient for success. After luck comes management.
Some companies, including AT&T, have started moving in the direction of adopting Edsger Dijkstra's formal methods, not to check the whole program, but at least to make sure the overall structure is sound. They've started reading sessions where programmers sit down and just read through the lines of code together, looking for typos and small bugs. Experiments show these editing sessions actually catch more mistakes than a lot of testing does. Down the road, many software developers hope they won't have to build huge programs from scratch anymore, but piece them together using a library of standard parts, well-tested sub-programs that can be used over and over again in many different programs. The idea is it would make the software business a little like the hardware business. Computer makers make their products out of standard chips and disk drives and cables, and general contractors build houses out of standard doors and 2x4s and pipes. The hope is software built out of standard parts will be as reliable and as stable as houses are. This is Dan Charles reporting.